Okay, welcome, folks. We're pleased to have Scott Stredenack Singer with us today, whose the title of his talk is Embodiment, Ethics, and Christian Athletics. I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say because he's just doing some really interesting work. He's a PhD candidate, and I understand he's going to be defending next week, so I don't know if we should congratulate you in advance or if that will jinx it, but he's getting his PhD in religious studies from Temple University, and his doctoral work focused on American evangelicalism and athletics in the late 20th century, looking at how evangelical communities have used athletics to define and teach masculinity to young men. And he's doing some particular work on Christian mixed martial arts ministries. I don't know if you're talking about that today, but I'd be really interested in hearing what that looks like and the gender anxieties that go along with all of that. That's going to be a chapter in a forthcoming book from Mercer University Press called God's Games and Globalization. So look for that next year. Scott's been pretty active in the American Academy of Religion, both as a graduate student representative and also on the steering committee for the group on religion, sport, and play. And this year he's doing teaching at several schools in the greater DC area. So Scott, welcome. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's my honor to speak with you today here at Eastern Mennonite University. I'd like to first thank Dr. Nancy Heise for inviting me, for Dr. Niss inviting me as part of the colloquium series, and thank you to Lois Shank for helping to organize all of the things that have made this possible. I've been invited here today to talk a little bit about Christianity's often ambivalent relationship with athletic culture. From St. Paul's use of athletic imagery in the Bible to describe faith in terms of a race and salvation in terms of a prize to be won, to Tim Tebow's brilliant utilization of college football fandom to evangelize on national television, Christian theologians, laymen, educators, psychologists, boys workers, urban reformers, parents, priests, and players have turned to physical culture as a place wherein they might come to know of themselves as Christians. For many Christian athletes and spectators, sports have helped them to better understand themselves as members of the body of Christ and to do the religious work that religious theorist David Chidesser has called the work of negotiating what it means to be a human. Today, I would like to discuss some of the more significant moments and movements that have shaped the contours of American Christian relationship with physical culture over the past century and a half. Despite normative understandings of Christianity's elevation of the soul above the body and its traditional preference for orthodoxy versus orthopraxy, the interplay between American Christian institutions and parachurch ministries and the secular social institutions of physical culture, sports entertainment, and athlete celebrity star power reveals a cultural nexus where the boundary between the sacred and the profane disappears. At this junction, religious authority and sacred messages can be found in the most unlikely of places and from the most unlikely of people. Coaches and players without any formal religious training nor affiliated with any particular denomination can be invested with sacred authority. Donning the mantle of the anointed preacher to champion causes they deem to be holy. As a multi-billion dollar industry built upon the physical labor of highly publicized athletes and often at great physical cost to themselves, professional sports inform many Americans' value systems, provide a source of mythological narratives, symbols, and rituals which strengthen group social cohesion and group formation. As such, research in this area can help us to understand and learn more about the widespread perceptions of religion in America and the role that religion plays in the everyday lives of people. My research into this odd nexus of faith and athletics explores the productions of bodies, both physical and symbolic, in sports evangelism, and how Christian athletes use their bodies as a medium to convey religious messages about gender and about Christian identity. Throughout this discussion today, I want to highlight the centrality of the body in American Christian sports discourses and what hopes advocates for Christian engagement with physical culture have had for the bodies of individual athletes, for the national body politic, and for the body of Christ, both symbolic and iconographic. Some pundits have advocated strenuous physical exertion for young men who might do the work of the church, while also encouraging women to participate in less rigorous activities in order to prepare their bodies for childbirth. Others, we shall see, hope to counteract perceptions of Christian effeminacy through producing hypermasculine images of the athletic Jesus. Whether symbolically aligning the physical well-being of elite young men with the manhood of the church, or tapping into the media frenzy for professional athletics to promote the gospel, sports evangelists have grounded their hopes in the physical bodies of athletes. As stained glass windows were once the scriptures to the illiterate Christian masses, so too have visual displays of Christian athletes' bodies come to supplement or sometimes even supplant the athletes' oral ministrations. To tell a story of American Christian engagement with athletics, I actually want to start in Victorian England in this movement called Muscular Christianity. As the name implies, Muscular Christianity was a theological movement defined by a commitment to physical and moral health and manliness in the Anglican Church. First developed in the novels of Tom Hughes and later adopted by the Anglican cleric Charles Kingsley, Muscular Christianity was a strand of masculinist Protestant philosophy aimed at counteracting the perceived feminine traits of the Anglican Church in industrial England. By promoting rigorous physical activity in Britain's boarding schools and universities, Muscular Christian supporters believed that they could counteract this crisis of masculinity that they perceived in English society. These fears of a flaccid English future included a disdain for sentimental Anglican worship led by hymn-singing women, concern for the deplorable health conditions of the rapidly expanding centers of industrial urbanization and the degenerative effects of managerial labor, and racial anxieties regarding an ever-increasing immigrant population from the colonies and from continental Europe of a community of diverse religious backgrounds. Thus, Muscular Christian proponents advocated raising the sons of Britain's white Protestant middle class in a manner that would produce robust men of the faith with physical and moral strength to respond to these several crises and who could successfully integrate themselves into Britain's imperial operations. It's impossible for me to overstate just how important the physical body was for these Muscular Christian enthusiasts. The sexually and racially charged anxieties of Muscular Christian writers were often demonstrated through images of the body as a site of socio-political conflict. Synodically, the bodies of young white middle-class males represented the body politic in Muscular Christian literature. Thus, the development of strong bodies became a central component of middle-class Anglophone strategy for attaining and retaining dominance of the public sphere amid an ever-changing social landscape. The pedagogical structure in which these young men would grow to become the leaders of tomorrow was physical activity and, most importantly, competitive physical sport. Muscular Christian advocates viewed boys' physical training and competitive athletics as the regimen that led to manliness, morality, health, and patriotism. Prominent in Victorian physiognomy was the belief that a person's character followed from their physical condition, a belief that reinforced racial and gender hierarchies already present in English society, as well as legitimating racist and sexist sentiments. Sport was the training ground for all the life lessons middle-class Anglo-Saxon boys would need in order to fulfill their destinies as masters of the universe. The Anglican cleric Charles Kingsley stated this plainly when he said, quote, "Games conduce not merely to physical, but to moral health. That in the playing fields, boys acquire virtues which no books can give them. That not merely daring and endurance, but better still, temper, self-restraint, fairness, honor, unenvious approbation of another's success, and all the give and take of life." In order to attract men to the faith, Muscular Christians also aim to Christianize lower-class sports through the adoption of safety rules. As you see in the image here, the older sport of mob football, which used to be played between different town parishes over many miles, involved whole towns in drunken revelry in the sort of Easter or pre-Lenten festivity. It was slowly adopted and Christianized by instituting limits of the playing field and adapting safety helmet. Sometimes you see those old leather football helmets. It really comes back from this rugby era here. The attire of the spectators in the background are a little bit faint to see in the image here. They're all nicely dressed in these high-class dark clothings, top hats, etc. This reinforces the idea that such games were useful for demonstrating one's physical superiority against one's social peers, but also doing so in the presence of social superiors as a way of asserting one's manliness. By asserting the manliness of Anglicanism and Anglicanism's approval of manly activities, Muscular Christians hoped to attract those men who were presumed to be otherwise beyond the church's reach. Charles Kingsley also suggested that such games produce the best type of male bodies, ones which manual laborers doing heavy lifting in the factories already possessed. Such belief led Kingsley to espouse a theology of the body that elevated muscularity, brawn, and the rough hands of working class men. Also important was the physical ability to violently exert one's will over an opponent. And this became a central facet of the type of masculinity that muscular Christians advocated. Muscular Christian leaders supported those recreations which channeled boyish rambunctiousness into disciplined martial skill, especially boxing. Having a violent disposition, properly guided, was something that they considered innate to true manliness. Thomas Carlyle, the headmaster of Rugby University, believed, quote, "Man is created to fight. He is perhaps best of all definable as a born soldier, his life a battle and a march under the right general." And general is capitalized there, so it's reference to God. Tom Hughes concurred, adding, "From the cradle to the grave, fighting, rightly understood, is the real, highest, honest business of every son of man." So you hear in there that epithet of Jesus, the real son of man. Well, a real son of man is a fighter in this case, and so it incorporates that idea about who Jesus was as well. The belief that manliness involved fighting for a good cause under the direction of God simultaneously ties the muscular Christian movement to British imperialism and to the faith's historic legacy of legitimating violent pastimes when it became politically expedient, as had happened previously in the Middle Ages, particularly the medieval jousting tournament, which was very useful for preparing people for the Crusades. Boxing, which had in early 19th centuries been viewed with derision as a rough and tumble low class activity, began to gain a level of social respectability as the century progressed. Tom Hughes advocated that boxing should be incorporated into the curricula of English boarding schools and working men's colleges as a useful Christian sport. By conditioning boys' physical bodies as well as their mental, and by providing a simple dramatic schema through which boys could be socialized towards one another, boxing was a crucible through which young men were conditioned for the hierarchical structures of English society, the imperial army, the industrialized economy, and the Anglican Church. So widespread was this belief in Victorian England that many public schools and slum missions also established boxing programs in the hope of teaching boys and adult males mastery over the emotions in the physical body and, quote, how to act like a gentleman. Thus, both educators and reformers within and outside the muscular Christian movement thought that the future of the church, state, and society depended upon the careful nurturing of young boys into robust men of the faith whose bodies were capable of doing the hard labor and sometimes necessary righteous violence required of both the King of England and the King of Heaven. By about the 1870s, 1880s, America's Protestant middle line, especially in the Northeast, had begun to adopt many of these English muscular Christian ideals. As other Christian leaders had done in the past, those of the late Victorian era increasingly began to adopt established and emerging forms of athletics under the presumption that sports could serve a utilitarian purpose. Late 19th and early 20th century social reformers active in the American Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the Boy Scouts of America, and the Young Men's Christian Association often fixed their hopes for social change on the healthy, usually white and male, physical bodies of the Christian populace. These reformers, according to historian Clifford Putney, quote, expressed faith in the power of strenuous activity to overcome the perceived moral defects of urbanization, cultural pluralism, and white-collar work. Manly strength imbued through physical recreation and athletic competition was intrinsically linked to social reform in the minds of many social reformers. Such muscular Christian ideals enjoyed widespread support from politicians like Teddy Roosevelt, the character of whom is here in the bottom left corner of this image of a YMCA businessman's class from 1886, I believe. It would enjoy support from evangelist preachers like Dwight L. Moody and the social gospeler Walter Rauschenbusch, and it was also highly supported by America's leading physical culturists, including football's Amos Alonzo Stagg, the first baseball commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and the Presbyterian minister James Naismith, who is more famously known for inventing basketball in a YMCA gym in 1891. Saving the world of today was a strenuous job that called for Christian men who lived a strenuous life. The maintenance of the general physique of the white race required a religion of the body, one that upheld rigorous exercise as a means to acquire the physical form necessary for real social work. Bicycling, gymnastics, rowing, and even the pugilistic arts were now more than pastimes. They were the training regimen of a generation of young men whose ultimate goal was the production of bodies fit to tackle their society's most pressing social concerns, interpreted through a white Protestant middle-class lens. Whereas boys were encouraged to increase their physical and spiritual manhood through the rough sports of football and boxing and weightlifting, women were often steered away from such activities from physical culturists. While the work of God's kingdom required strong men with defined musculature, it also required women whose bodies were physically fit to produce offspring and to be attractive, of course. Thus, early American muscular Christians often prohibited the fairer sex from taking part in combat or contact sports for fear of damaging their reproductive organs, or which might result in them developing an unwomanly figure. Furthermore, women were frequently admonished to maintain the virtue of modesty, even when being physically active, lest lecherous men peek in on them during their physical exercises. It was not uncommon for women who participated in basketball games to do so in a locked gym that kept spectators out, unless any young man decided to peek in and get excited. In keeping with the gender binaries of physical culture, women were also ushered towards less strenuous exercises like bodily calisthenics, leisurely biking, doubles tennis, and six-player basketball. Such activities promoted weight loss without building large amounts of muscle. This division that steered men towards exercises that aided in bulking up and women towards exercises which aided in slimming down has remained an integral part of American physical culture, in which gender and sexual identity are policed through socially prescribed athletic activities, reflecting the sex-segregated and sort of classist standards of beauty. For young men, such athletic activities were promoted in Christianized boys' work organizations across the urban centers of the industrial Northeast. The Young Men's Christian Association and the Boy Scouts of America offered holier alternatives to the normal socializing institutions of the city, the brothel and the tavern. These organizations successfully blended patriotism, the spirit of the urban revival, Victorian physical culture to assuage middle-class male anxieties about society, the feminized church, and what to do with unwanted male sexual urges. YMCA advertisements traded in images of the bodies of boys and young men, effectively demonstrating that their programs created robust and attractive men for a robust and attractive faith. Such programs, it was hoped, would channel boyish rambunctiousness and sexual energies into more wholesome, fitness-oriented pursuits. Interdenominationally, the Men in Religion Forward movement gathered the institutional support of Protestant denominational brotherhoods, the Gideons, the International Sunday School Committee, and YMCAs across the nation to aid them in their attempt to remasculinize Protestantism by bridging the gender gap in church work and attendance. The development of these institutions across the northeastern and midwestern cities, coupled with educational trends favoring the incorporation of physical activity into school curricula, demonstrated the widespread approval of muscular Christian enterprises in late 19th and early 20th century America. This zeal fed into the muscular Christian support for the Great War, which in the eyes of many mainland Protestant leaders provided an opportunity to redeem the world by force. Though not every muscular Christian was hawkish, many believed that the war against the Germans was a moment for collective righteousness, wherein Christian men, American Christian men, could engage in the virtuous violence befitting their manly faith. War elevated those male virtues, which many muscular Christians, including psychologist G. Stanley Hall, believe were stifled by mothers and sisters who were otherwise well-meaning but were crushing the innate violence inherent in masculinity. Furthermore, the Great War also marked the first large-scale governmental effort to regulate the health of the bodies of American males. Compulsory military service and training turned artisans, bakers, and factory laborers into able-bodied men of soldiery. Basic training was an orchestrated governmental effort to purge flabbiness and brittleness from male bodies. In theory, those Christian soldiers armed with moral muscle could fight what YMCA missionary Sherwood Eddy called, quote, a war to end all wars, to protect womanhood, to destroy militarism and autocracy. Yes, to use militarism to destroy militarism makes perfect sense, right? Fighting rightly understood and carried out was the responsibility of every red-blooded American Christian male during this time of tribulation. However, despite such hopes, the harsh tutelage of the Great War had tarnished the philosophical underpinnings of the muscular Christian movement, particularly in Protestant New England. Frankly, moral muscle was no match for tanks, Gatling guns, and mustard gas. The links that muscular Christian enthusiasts had made between muscularity, morality, and God's favor were utterly severed on the battlefields of Europe. Furthermore, back home, white Protestant men's assumptions about their physical superiority were increasingly tested. African Americans like Jack Johnson, Irish Catholic and Jewish young men began to dominate boxing, the sport that that American muscular Christians had equated with the ultimate display of manliness and righteousness, as well as the perfect display of physical prowess and physique. In 1919, baseball's Chicago Black Sox scandal, wherein members of the team were accused of intentionally tossing the World Series for money, was a sensationalized rebuttal of the belief that sports participation imbued morality. And as Niebuhrian neo-Orthodox theology came into vogue in mainline Protestant circles, the progressive era's faith in the capabilities of Christianized men to save all of society began to wither. In this period between 1920 and between the 1920s and 1940s, there's a lot of change happening within American Protestant physical culture. Muscular Christianity's commitment to the moral and physical well-being of American men through rigorous programs designed to create robust men of the faith had begun to fall out of ideological favor. However, even as muscular Christianity had waned in liberal Protestant circles, it ironically survived among fundamentalists. Even before the war, leading advocates of muscular Christianity were slowly being replaced by a generation whose primary concern was not the salvation of society, but the salvation of souls. Continuing a trend which had begun near the turn of the century, the underlying ideological justification for Christian engagement with sports was slowly supplanted by a concern for what the emerging realm of professional athletics had to offer as a tool of evangelism. Initially, conservative Protestants were among the leading figures policing the boundaries between Christianity and sport, construing the relationship as one of antagonism but brimming with evangelistic potential. No one better demonstrated that than baseball player Billy Sunday. Once called the most advertised man in the religious world, Sunday used his fame as a ball player to attract audiences who might otherwise not hear his message. Sunday did not believe that baseball playing made one a better Christian. In fact, his personal experience was the absolute opposite of that. His life as a baseball player was defined by gambling, drinking, loose women, you name it. That did not mean that for Sunday that baseball was useless for Christian causes. For Sunday, his baseball career's greatest purpose was a means to garner audiences to hear his prayer. Quote, "Lord, save us from offhanded, flabby-cheeked, brittle-boned, weak-kneed, thin-skinned, pliable, plastic, spineless, effeminate, sissified, three-carat Christianity." Like other muscular Christians before him, Sunday framed the fate of the faith in a gendered language fixating on the perceived physical weaknesses of the body of Christ, criticizing softness as anathema to Christian manhood. His diatribes against, I'm quoting again, hog-jowled, weasel-eyed, sponge-collar, mush-fisted, jelly-spined, four-flushing Christians fit squarely within the larger gender anxieties of the muscular Christian worldview. Over time, Sunday became increasingly critical of professional sports and other elements of what he considered to be a secular anti-Christian culture. And by the time of his death in 1935, Sunday, along with many of his other fundamentalist brethren, favored a total separation from the dominant culture of American life, including its aerobic arts. For him, he thought that baseball had lost whatever salvific hope it might have had. Yet, of course, that's not how the story ends in American life. Not every person of fundamentalist or conservative theological persuasion was content to live on the periphery of American society. Seeking to reestablish their political and theological commitments at the center of American public life, neo-evangelical leaders like J. Elwin Wright, Billy Graham, Charles Fuller, and Harold J. Kinga were determined to save the nation from its own moral laxity. Athletics proved to be a major component of this plan. Picking up the mantle of Billy Sunday, some neo-evangelicals, Pentecostals, and fundamentalists began to use their fame, won through athletic achievement, to influence the moral compass of and religious beliefs of the audiences who would come to listen to them. More than anyone else, Billy Graham made sport an integral part of his marketing strategy to attract possible converts across the nation and eventually the world. A traveling spokesperson for the Evangelical Enterprise Youth for Christ, Graham was part of a generation of conservative Protestants who perceived the reach that athletes could have and the potential impact upon the great mission. After all, the sports pages were among the most popular segments of the daily newspapers among male readers, and newspapermen actually depended upon the sports pages to drive profit margins. Those who wrote the syndicated sports columns were, in the words of The Nation magazine, quote, "the men who make America's gods." Billy Graham, an astute observer of mass media trends, benefited greatly from the cult of athletic celebrity and nurtured this that was nurtured by national sports coverage. Graham's efforts were part of a larger focus on attracting youth to evangelical Protestantism. In order to attract larger and larger crowds for both his Youth for Christ rallies and his various crusades held in sports stadia across the nation, this image is what is now LP Field in Nashville, Tennessee, was then Vanderbilt, Vanderbilt Stadium. Graham frequently enlisted the help of celebrity athletes who shared many of his theological convictions. Long-distance runner Gil Dodds, collegiate boxing champion Bob Finley, and track star Louis Zamperini, whose exploits were recently featured in the biopic Unbroken, were frequent guests of Graham's stages. Adding these names to his promotional material was one of several means Graham employed to attract the unchurched. From time to time, Gil Dodds, himself a part-time preacher nicknamed the Flying Parson, was asked to run laps around the audience before the show. Simultaneously, this provided a little bit of entertainment for which revivalist Christianity is known, while also demonstrating what made Dodds an authority on the sacred subject that he was about to talk about. Muscular Christian philosophy presumed that an outward, healthy, and active body was a sign of inward moral health. This suggested that Dodds' ability to run further and faster than any other man in the world meant that he possessed a great spiritual knowledge. Thus, athletic prowess also suggested that he might carry a divine message of Christ's salvation, effortlessly gliding between the role of preacher and pundit as the moment called. The mid-20th century also witnessed an institutional re-engagement between Protestantism and sport here in the United States. In 1952, former Taylor University basketball coach Don Odell founded Venture for Victory. This was an international ministry which promoted basketball games in East Asia as a means of attracting audiences who might hear the evangelical message that people would preach, that his players would preach at halftime to the audience. At the high school level, Eastern Oklahoma A&M coach Don McLennan founded the Fellowship of Christian Athletes in 1954 in the hopes of encouraging players to use their social position as the leading cultural representatives of the school to promote the gospel among their fellow students. And on college campuses, Dave Hanna's Athletes in Action Ministry, established in 1966, proselytized among student athletes and recruited them for traveling teams who might preach to crowds drawn to athletic competition. This was weightlifting competitions, basketball games, volleyball, so on and so on. Stating his goals bluntly, Hanna hoped that if he could convert athletes, he could convert their fans, saying, quote, "A society looking up to athletes as heroes must find those heroes looking up to God." Seeing the neo-evangelical successful use of sports, the Pentecostal preacher Oral Roberts soon brought collegiate athletics to his university campus, claiming that they, quote, "offered one of the greatest opportunities for Christian witness without which millions of people might never be reached." Simultaneously, having an athletic department provided his institution with national advertising, and it put Pentecostalism on the sports pages of all places for Pentecostalism to be found in this heart of American popular culture. Not to be outdone, in 1971, fundamentalist leader Jerry Falwell, when he's establishing Liberty University, made sure to designate money for an athletic program, which he hoped would do for fundamentalism what BYU had done for the Mormon movement and what Notre Dame had been doing for Roman Catholics for about a century at this point. Within one generation, conservative Protestants had gone from the most vocal opponents of Christian engagement with athletic culture to its most ardent supporters. In the 1970s, home exercise video cassettes and the advent of the bodybuilder celebrity movement, thriving in the films of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sly Sylvester Stallone, raised America's body consciousness. Historian Mark Stern's analysis of census data and popular press reports suggested that the number of fitness clubs in America nearly doubled between 1977 and 1981, and then nearly doubled again between 81 and the end of Reagan's term in January 1989. This is the era of Rocky and Rambo and Predator and all the bodybuilder killer films. The number of gym memberships in America also grew exponentially during this period, from nearly 1.7 million gym memberships in 1971 to over 10 times that figure by 1987. Christian consumers were among the leading figures in this cultural trend. An explosion of Christian dietary literature during the 70s and 80s saw numerous works on physical fitness reach the top of religious publishers' bestseller list. However, bodily ideals within both explicitly Christian literature and its secular counterparts skewed heavily along a gender binary. Many of the works Christian readers purchased were targeted towards white middle-class women whose social and economic positions allowed for overeating to be a problem in their daily lives. These women's social circles also place spiritual emphasis upon thinness by casting flabbiness as a sin, which threatened the spiritual health of the individual and the collective health of the body of Christ. The development of lay ministries for women's weight loss, such as diet, discipline, and discipleship, Overeaters Victorious First Place, and Way Down Workshop, were adaptations of secular movements like Weight Watchers and Overeaters Anonymous. Christian exercise programs such as Body and Soul Ministries, Believer Size, Word Size, Cross Training, Jehovics, and Praise Aerobics served as further evidence of the intensification of these anxieties within Christian women's circles during the 70s and 80s. Even until today, church-hosted weight loss programs, Christian-themed dieting books, and exercise videos have remained a very important part of American Christians' popular engagement with physical culture. Adapting to modern trends, Christian-themed CrossFit gyms, yoga studios, and even mixed martial arts dojos dot the national landscape. Undoubtedly, the American middle class obsession with physique has deep roots in this muscular Christian belief that the physical body is the outward manifestation of the virtues of the interior soul, complete with its racial, sexist, and classist stratifications of body types and diverging standards of beauty. While Christian sports ministries have continued to stress the production of athletic bodies, increasingly it seems that the justification for Christian engagement with athletic culture is defined by this process of recruiting athletes for evangelistic purposes, both locally, amateur, and professional athletes. In the ministries that I study, showcasing the bodies of Christian athletes has been a central pedagogical strategy for negotiating Christian identity and responding to political, sexual, and gender concerns. If you remember in the late 70s and early 1980s, America is undergoing a significant oil crisis. There's a lot of fear of national decline, and this is really what's sort of driving Reagan's rise to power, leaving from the governorship of California to become president in 1981. Playing off of those fears of American effeminacy and desire for a strong American life, you start to see the development of American Christian strength ministries. Evangelical strength ministries, in which former competitive bodybuilders and karate champions put their physical abilities on display, have since emerged as one of the more interesting developments within sports evangelism. In such ministries, the hypermuscular physique of the comic book superhero and the performative routines of the vaudevillian strongman have been transfigured into symbols of the raw power of Christianity and of God himself, especially in an era when it seems that Satan has so strong a grip on society. By breaking baseball bats, ripping phone books, bending steel, snapping handcuff links, smashing concrete, running through slabs of ice, exploding hot water balloons with their breath, Christian athletes have displayed their strength in front of U.S. Church and school audiences, contextualizing their abilities and their physiques within personal testimonies of the transformative power of Jesus Christ. All of this despite Jesus' personal rebuke to his followers for demanding signs and wonders of his power in John 4:48. With names like the Power Team, Team Impact, the Power Force, Strike Force, Truth Force, Strength Team, and Omega Force, these ministries offer the unambiguous promise of a Christian masculinity defined through physical strength. Such presentations have all the subtlety of professional wrestling. Indeed, the spectacle of the performance and the very real possibility of injury, coupled with the assurance that Jesus is even more powerful than the thick-necked men on the stages, offers a thrilling circus in which Christian athletes' faith is quantified in terms of height, weight, bicep circumference, and the number of concrete slabs that one can break with one's face. The audience, too, is promised that true Christian faith has the strength to overcome the metaphorical rebar and handcuffs that bind them to the wages of sin and death. There is, too, something hilarious and a little overtly sexual about such performances, as can be seen on the tortured yet ecstatic faces of the performers. In such ministries, it is not uncommon for the wives and children of the men on stage to be integrated into the show in order to silently assure the audience that the spectacle of broad-chested men groaning and sweating with one another is indeed a heterosexual spectacle of broad-chested men groaning and sweating with one another. In more recent years, several such ministries have expanded to include female bodybuilders who, in keeping with the gender dynamics of such performances, wear their hair long, show less skin, and even on occasion wear leopard print warm-ups, as you can see here with Saber of the Power Team, appropriately sexualizing them in this traditional model of heterosexual desire, just in case you're confused about Saber's sexuality. Often drawing their visual cues from secular cultural productions like comic books and the bodybuilder killer action movie genre. These ministries frequently showcase the beefcake element of their performers, not so subtly linking the Christian identity with sexual prowess, even if in what seems to be a rather homoerotic fashion. Such bodily displays might run afoul of normative Christian calls to modesty and prohibitions against glorification of the flesh. Yet with each scream and whistle from the audience, and with each knowing smirk of the performers as they strategically disrobe before the next act of sanctified destruction, audience members are reminded of the sexual capital of real Christian athletes. Such ministries promise that Christians too can fully perform the hegemonic models of masculinity and femininity modeled in American popular culture. Elsewhere, other athlete evangelists have thrown modesty to the wind in pursuit of a higher calling. ESPN, the magazine's body issue, which first debuted in 2009 as a competitor to Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, has featured dozens of Christian athletes posing in the buff. Notably, evangelical athlete celebrities like cross-country runner Ryan Hall, Jehovah's Witness Serena Williams, San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, or the mixed martial artist John Bones Jones, they've all shed their clothes to take part in the specialized Bodies We Want subsection. The name of the section, Bodies We Want, of course, plays on the double entendre of desire. These bodies, so the audience are told, are desirable as both objects of emulation and as the object of erotic affection. Defending his nakedness, Ryan Hall invoked the special plan God has for his body. Quote, I'm a Christian and I think God made amazing bodies for us. I believe that God gave me a gift and I need to get everything out of it. This is the little explanatory note at the bottom of his image in the magazine. What is interesting is Hall's desire to naturalize his body as the result of God's grace, while also simultaneously being aware of the years of asceticism and discipline necessary to produce it. For many such athletes, it is faith in God and in God's blessings of their bodies that motivates them to take up the cross of athletic training in order to achieve maximum performance, just as that faith is a necessary component that motivates them to actually put that body on display. Other athletes have recognized the evangelistic potential of such bodily displays. Olympic hurdler Lolo Jones, more famous today for her evangelical commitment to remain abstinent before marriage, was one of the first athletes to be approached by ESPN's new issue. Yet, without having a higher purpose, Jones cannot justify such an obvious affront to her sense of decorum. These are her words. Pose naked? No way. I'm a very strong Christian. That's against my morals. Yet, after a moment, the Iowa native began to reconsider the pitch. Her sponsors reminded her of the wholesome image of ESPN's parent company, the Disney Corporation. And after some careful deliberation, Jones hoped that her photograph would send a positive message about body image to young girls. She's already an adept marketer with more social media followers than any other female track athlete in the world. Jones hoped that such an image would convey the idea that young women, quote, don't have to be skinny or starve themselves, and that they can be strong and beautiful but don't need to be 110 pounds. Jones thus overcame her initial hesitancy to pose nude when she reconciled the medium with its ability to carry her message. For her, this wasn't a betrayal of her Christian faith. It was an opportunity to put that faith into practice by using her body as a visual discourse on weight and beauty. Though Jones's decision was widely panned by secular critics in the New York Times and the Des Moines, Iowa Register, it was well received within evangelical circles. Dana Gresh, who is the founder of the abstinent ministry Pure Freedom, defends Jones's choice by arguing that, quote, following in the footsteps of Jesus Christ is a messy business. And Gresh sees in these images of Lolo Jones a Christian work which is, quote, muddy and glorious all at the same time. Christianity Today's Laura Leonard acknowledges that the political currency of such images, saying, quote, the world-class runner shows that virginity isn't just for nerdy 18-year-olds, and that following God's plan for sexuality can be really hard. She goes on to describe the Christian view of sexuality, according to this author, as countercultural, recognizing that Jones's images have, quote, helped put a new face on abstinence, that it's a legitimate choice embraced by attractive, successful people who've had ample opportunities for sex, but who aren't because of God's call on their lives. The Jones participates in this commercialized, sexualized culture. Her supporters say that it does not disqualify Jones's personal belief that such body image work stems from her deeply rooted Christian commitment to promoting healthy body image among young women. Not to be outdone, Tim Tebow, another famously abstinent Christian athlete, has showcased his body in a series of jockey underwear advertisements. Yes, the sexually abstinent evangelical is an underwear model, and that's not a contradiction for Tim Tebow. An astute observer of his place in popular culture, the former Denver Broncos quarterback has said that God has given him a platform from which to use his athletic talents for God's greater purposes. In the words of his own semi-autobiography, Tebow, quote, realized that young women and men heard his answer and that there was a chance that they might find encouragement in his words and lifestyle to do the same thing and wait until they were married to engage in sexual activity. Tebow goes on to say that he believes that God has had a hand in making his abstinent lifestyle a matter of public discourse, saying, quote, it got a lot of people talking about abstinence. Seeing my words have that kind of impact has made me realize that God has a plan for this too. However, as you can see in these images, the abstinence of Tim Tebow is one of sexual prowess. Though seemingly innocent, such images of the former Denver Broncos quarterback show him surrounded by whips, chains, saddles, and a lot of the other implements of sexual domination. This leaves no doubt in the minds of the viewer who's the real stud in the stable. Playing off these themes of both the jockey brand and the Broncos logo and the sexuality of Tim Tebow himself. The fan commentary for such images online suggests that the sexual overtones are not lost on the general public, with viewers describing Tebow as, quote, beefcake and the total package. Some going so far to say that these images have helped them fill erotic fantasies. Clearly, Tebow's form of abstinence isn't the same as the typical virginal male of American popular culture. Jones and Tebow both perform such erotic functions while espousing the virtues of remaining abstinent before marriage. These images present well-known virginal athletes as sex symbols whose personal erotic capital raises the eroticism of virginity as a sexual identity for young adolescents. By placing themselves at the center of sexualized commercial culture, Jones and Tebow continue a long-standing tradition of reframing evangelicalism as a sex-positive religious identity and abstinence as an erotic and popular sexual identity for young Christians. Excuse me. More recently, over the past 15 years, the emergence of Christian mixed martial arts ministries have given other athletes chances to display their bodies in a rather violent fashion. International MMA ministries such as Anointed Fighter cater to a fierce flock of men and women, encouraging amateur competitors to use their public platform to promote the faith of Jesus Christ. At the local level, congregations across the United States have begun to add amateur MMA training into their ministerial programming or MMA viewing parties or incorporating MMA into their sermons. And while some of these ministries offer the services to female congregants, most of the organizational leadership, participants, and spectators of these programs are the men of the congregations. The spread and development of such ministries shows that MMA-related programming, sermons, and viewing parties are becoming increasingly popular ways of attracting men to the Christian faith. Although several religious leaders have initially panned MMA for its unabashedly violent nature, many American evangelical leaders have begun to make concessions for MMA subculture within their churches. In an apology for these ministries, Albert Moeller, who's the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, has argued, quote, the main issue is not the legitimacy of martial arts, but the fact that these churches are making a self-conscious effort to reach young men and boys with some kind of proof that Christianity is not a feminized and testosterone-free faith that appeals only to women. Megachurch pastor Mark Driscoll claims that men are turned off from the modern church, which ignores or otherwise tries to dissuade men's violent nature. Quote, as a pastor and a Bible teacher, I think God made men masculine. Men are made for combat, men are made for conflict, men are made for dominion. That's just the way men are made. Contemporary American evangelicals incorporating MMA into their churches, or at least tacitly endorsing its presence in other churches, is not too far removed from the arguments of the first generation of muscular Christians who suggested that men abandoned the church because the sentimental church had first abandoned them. For their supporters, MMA ministries are an appropriate antidote, to this problem. MMA is a means of reaching non-church-going, rough-and-tumble men who do not identify with feminized Christianity. God, the church, and society need these men. Reading such apologetics, one gets the impression that MMA ministries don't work because God approves of them, but that supporters believe God approves of MMA ministries because they get results among this niche market. Charles Petit, author of the fictionalized novel The Warrior, prefaces his book by claiming, quote, "We need spiritually strong young men and women for Christ to stand up in arenas like MMA and proclaim their love of Christ." This also seems to be a common view among the mostly white male crowd of internet commentators on MMA enthusiast websites. God's church, it seems, is in desperate need of real warrior men, men who can take the blows for the church and dish them out too. An interesting historical note, the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, which is the largest promotional body for MMA, was sold to a new organization in 2001, shortly before 9/11, for $2 million. Since then, in the 15 years since, they sold it just earlier this year for $4 billion, a 2,000-fold increase in the profitability of the sport. It's uniquely tied to a post-9/11 model of American masculinity, and one which has been reinforced time and time again, particularly among evangelical leaders and their support for the war on terror, particularly when it came to discussing the morality and the ethics of the invasion of Iraq in 2004. Many of the same supporters of MMA ministries were the same people going on CNN to back President George W. Bush in the invasion. Today, however, in conclusion, such overt displays of athletes' bodies, their powers, their capacity for receiving and inflicting pain, and their sexual potential have played an integral part in negotiating Christian sexual identity in American history. This has included responses to sexual, racial, and political anxieties, both in how those anxieties have been assuaged and how they have been exacerbated by athletic successes of others. Merging faith with spectacle, Christian athletic history suggests that the artful showcasing of the flesh is as much a part of witnessing to the faith as pregame prayers, on-field performances, off-field testimonies, and genuflections. The sculpting of the body, its staging and adornment, and displaying its strength and sexual allure are strategies for signifying one's successful internalization of gender norms and Christian political commitments through athletic performance. Researchers of American religious culture and history can look at different communities' interactions with athletic culture and the sorts of bodily displays that have either been permitted or prohibited in order to understand more about how those communities negotiate what it means to be a human being and what it is to be a Christian in this place and time. Such images and performances tell us much about how these communities understand embodiment, modesty, and what concerns drive them to pursue unorthodox means of proselytism and ministerial programming. At this nexus of Christ and culture, we see God's people coming to know of themselves as humans, yearning to bring together their bodies and souls. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott, for a thought-provoking talk. We have a few minutes for conversation, questions, comments. Please come to the mic just so that your thoughts or questions are recorded on the podcast.
Scott, you talked about just in the last paragraph or two about the increase in the economic gain of the MMA, I think you said. Mm-hmm. But you didn't say much about economics as it relates to athletics and evangelicalism and the role in that. Do you see a role in just the sheer economic impact for the church?
I'll give you a couple of historical examples. One, it's not a historical accident that professional athletics is something that truly emerges more in the post-1940s and early 1950s period. You see professional football develop in the 60s, professional basketball in the 70s, and all that's tied to the advent of television and getting a TV in middle-class homes around the United States. So the increased prominence of athletes who are visually beamed into the homes of many Americans coincides nicely with the development of evangelical sports ministries. One from Billy Graham's adaptation and recruitment of athletes to join him on the Youth for Christ stages, but also in the Olympics of the 1950s, pole vaulter Bob Richards is a famous Christian celebrity because he's defeating the Russians in Moscow at the Olympics. And so there's a unique tie there between his performance on the TV, and then what happens to him later on is he's adapted both as a spokesperson for Christian movements. He's a minister in the Church of the Brethren. He's also one of the first Wheaties man. So he gets to market that very clearly. If you go to back to those strength ministries, the Power Team in particular, one of the adaptations of evangelical practice would be to adopt advanced advertising. So before the ministry would come into town, months in advance, they would put up flyers and let people know and send packets and pamphlets to the churches that they can quantify how many souls they've saved and how much money it takes to get the show running and how much money that they've actually raised. And these are multi-million dollar ministries. So yes, John Jacobs, who is the founder of the Power Team, lived a very comfortable life throughout the 1980s as this ministry was at its heyday. But since then, it's kind of fallen out of vogue, and most people who are participating in that ministry do so on a part-time basis. And many of them are also part-time pastors in their home churches as well. I also want to say about economics. I might go back to these two in particular have turned a pretty penny, putting their bodies on display. And one of the things that I think is a very important part of understanding sports evangelism in general, it's really easy to see sort of the hypocrisy of these images. For a lot of viewers, that these are supposed to be the vanguard of sexual mores in modern day America, these two abstinent athletes, who are getting paid a pretty penny to show their skin. And the hypocrisy is the easy thing to see. At the same time, I don't think that means that the fact that they're making a little money off of this in any way detracts from the message that they bring into popular culture. And this is how they are known today. Neither of them are successful athletes at this point, at the highest levels that they previously were. So that's all I'll say about economics at this moment.
This may stretch you a bit further, but I was wondering, after you've studied the evangelical positions and related to sports, would you at all be ready to concur that evangelicals make more successful coaches than non-evangelicals?
I am unwilling to speak on that because I just don't have the win-loss record next to me. And then there's the harder part. How do you define who is an evangelical and who's not? And so that's always a concern. I will say that the general sort of philosophy within this tradition isn't that being a Christian will make one a better athlete for on-field performances, but it will make one a better human, and hopefully that will lead you to being a better athlete, if not in a straight-up physical performance, at least in the sort of way that one carries oneself on the football field or the basketball court, et cetera. I don't know what it is to be a Christian coach exactly, or to juxtapose that against being a non-Christian coach. Is Bobby Knight a Christian coach? Because he screams at his players, I'm not sure that disqualifies him. Because if that's the case, I got to throw out a lot of the people in my studies. Anything else?
You addressed a little bit the racial anxieties in the early period of the muscular Christianity movement. And your more recent illustrations primarily feature white athletes and bodies, Serena Williams being, well, not entirely here. But I think it would be interesting to know, and I don't know this, whether the sort of the visibility of amazing bodies across professional sports, which features a lot of people of color, whether that has had any impact on contemporary evangelical discourse about bodies and athletics and so forth. Where's the anxiety level on the diversity part of it?
I did not include it in this presentation, but I'd be remiss to not mention the Promise Keepers movement of the 1990s. Billy Graham, even back in the 40s and 50s, his Youth for Christ movement is one of the more integrated Christian movements in the United States. And these sports ministries, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and Athletes in Action in particular, really begin to emerge in integrated school systems or on college campuses. And as professional athletics and college athletics increasingly attracted African-American players, the ministries adapted as well. As you go forward into the 1990s, the Promise Keepers movement, which is this men's movement that was that routinely sold out stadiums, and that's where they had their events, featured racial reconciliation as one of its major components, and one of its main reasons to attract men to come and join this movement. At the same time in the 1990s, some of the more prominent evangelical athletes who were not necessarily displaying their physical bodies in such of the same way as these people up here on the wall are right now, many of whom were African Americans, including A.C. Green, the L.A. Lakers power forward, who was a champion for the abstinence movement. He's something of a precursor to the Tebow, Lolo Jones generation. I want to say it was in 1994. A.C. Green, Daryl Strawberry, Barry Sanders, and David Robinson, a Hall of Famer basketball player, joined forces to form a rap supergroup called Athletes for Abstinence, and they produced a one-time pro-abstinence rap song to appeal to urban youth in the hopes of changing abstinence from being something that was associated within the Black community with a white specific movement as something that they hope that young African-American men would follow as well, as something of a countercultural movement to the sort of sexual ethics that you would hear promoted in hip-hop and rap at the same time. One thing that I didn't include that I didn't know how to make it fit within the context of bodies on display that I think is a really interesting talking point for modern Christian discourse is what do we make of Colin Kaepernick's protest? Everything about athletics, Christianity, and ethics, Colin Kaepernick is kind of the it guy of the day. And since the protest has begun, there's lots of talk online accusing him of being a Muslim. He's not. He's raised in a Christian household and is publicly grounded his protest in his faith. What I find interesting is his kneeling protest is about the same genuflection that Tim Tebow made so famous years ago that we call the Tebowing pose now as a way of celebrating touchdowns. And I see here two Christian athletes whose genuflections are taken in such wildly divergent ways by America, both of them were very divisive. Kaepernick today and Tebow's genuflections in the years past, and both of whom have been modeled by athletes, particularly high school athletes across the country today. Some of whom have been chastised for modeling Tebow's behavior for unsportsmanlike conduct sometimes at high school games, and even more recently, just last week, a team in East Texas had their entire season canceled for kneeling during the national anthem. The school board said, well, you can't play football if that's what you're going to do. Historically speaking, Christians not engaging with athletic culture or not bowing down to the symbols of the state, that would have made perfect sense for Christians in the first century and the Roman gladiatorial games and all of the sermons of Theodore Mopsuesta and Tertullian of Carthage and Augustine of Hippo, at which they routinely denounce sporting events, particularly the gladiatorial games, as inherently anti-Christian, and for these obvious reasons of also promoting the Roman government. Fast forward 1700 years, and that's not the way that we understand the way sports are supposed to operate today. It is a legacy of muscular Christianity that athletics and patriotism and morality are intrinsically linked to one another. And I think that that's is a good discussion to have, even if I couldn't put it into this topic today. Any other questions?
Well, thank you again.
Thank you all so much. Thank you.
Welcome to light refreshments, reception afterwards, and see you all next month, November 16. Jerry Holsapo will be our presenter next month.